Congressman Bob Edgar's bill, which he referred to establish an advisory committee on women veterans to the Veterans Administration, was signed into law last November, and the committee has been established and has begun to meet. This is Fresh Air. It's 4 o'clock, and you're tuned to WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. In just a moment, we'll be joined by a very special guest, former First Lady Rosalynn Carter. You might recall Dizzy Gillespie's visit to the Carter White House for a jazz concert on the White House lawn.
President.
Which one?
His Highness has asked us to play a tune that we played at the White House when we were here before.
All right.
We're going to play this tune, in which the name of it is Salt Peanuts.
All right. Oh.
Now, wait a minute, but there are some diplomatic strings attached. To wit, that the president himself, his majesty,
right on,
sang the lyrics to Salt Peanuts.
Salt peanuts.
Wait. I just wanna ask one question. I just got one question. Would you like to go on the road with us?
I might have to after tonight.
Dizzy Gillespie and President Carter at the jazz concert on the White House lawn. Last week, Rosalynn Carter and Betty Ford spoke at a conference on modern first ladies, private lives, and public duties. Many of the issues raised at this conference, like how the responsibilities of the presidency affect the marriage, and how much power the president's spouse has in her own right, are also addressed in Rosalynn Carter's new memoir, First Lady from Plains. Rosalynn Carter is my guest on Fresh Air. Rosalynn Carter grew up in the middle of Plains, Georgia, 3 miles away from the Carter family farm. She met Jimmy Carter when she was 17, and he was 20 and attending the U.S. Naval Academy. They were married just after his graduation in 1946. She was grateful that his naval career took them out of Plains to Norfolk, Virginia, New London, Connecticut, Hawaii, and San Diego, California. She was heartbroken when her husband insisted on returning to Plains to run the family peanut farm after the death of his father. She feared this return would compromise her new independence and she'd be forced into the role of a conventional housewife. But it was in Plains that she learned how to be a businesswoman, eventually overseeing much of the financial management of the farm. When her husband began his political career, Rosalynn Carter says she was terrified by public speaking. She overcame her fears as she tirelessly campaigned with him in his successful bids for state senate and Georgia governor. Rosalynn Carter's new memoir covers all these years, as well as her 4 years in the White House, which began on January 20, 1977, when Jimmy Carter was inaugurated the 39th President of the United States. The Carters now live in Plains, Georgia. First Lady from Plains is published by Houghton Mifflin. Rosalynn Carter, welcome to Fresh Air. It's an enormous pleasure to meet you and to have you here.
Thank you.
Is there any unofficial job description that exists for First Ladies? Any guide that exists on paper anywhere?
No.
How did you know what was expected of you?
Well, I really didn't know what I could do when I got to the White House. Jimmy had been governor, and I had worked on projects that I was interested in and had to learn a lot of things the hard way at home because there were no precedents. We had a new mansion and no staff, and I had to start from scratch in that to and learn how to do everything, entertain, and the state legislature in Washington, I entertain members of Congress, entertain ambassadors from foreign countries in Washington, I entertain heads of state. So I thought that it would possibly be a little bit like the governor's mansion, and it was. And when I got there, I learned that a first lady can do just about what she wishes to. She can be a hostess at the White House and not be involved in issues if she doesn't want to be, and not be involved in projects. But there's so many opportunities when you get there and so many things that you can do that I think it would be a real waste not to take advantage of those opportunities.
Do you think that the movement for equality for women has changed the role of the First Lady and the public's perception and expectations of the First Lady?
I think so. As the role of women has expanded, the role of the First Lady has expanded. I really don't believe that a First Lady would move into the White House now and not want to do something. I just don't think women are going to be content, not to have a sense of accomplishment, or feel like they're their own person or doing something, whether that is being a good mother or a good wife or both, or having their own career. I think that women should have the opportunity to do what they are best suited to and what they want to do. And I think that's what happens in the White House now. But I do think that a First Lady there now will want to use her influence, and she has influence.
How did you choose your priorities in the White House?
Well, I had always, for many years, not always, but for many years, worked on mental health issues ever since Jimmy was governor, and I became interested in that, in traveling around the state, in the campaign, and talking to people and about their problems, and that came up so often. Will your husband do for my mentally retarded child, or my brother or sister, or my relative who is mentally retarded or emotionally disturbed, mentally ill? And so I asked Jimmy about it one day, and he said that if that was what I wanted to do and what I wanted to work on, it would be good, because he'd been in the state senate and he knew the need. And when we got to the governor's mansion, I knew that's what I wanted to do. And then after working in the governor's mansion, we really developed a good program in Georgia for the mentally afflicted. Then when I traveled in the country after being so interested for 4 years there, I sought out the mental facilities in the different states. And there's so many needs in the country. There were some really good places, good programs, but there was such a need in other areas that I knew that it would be a wonderful opportunity to be able to work from a nationwide basis. And then too, I came in contact with elderly citizens in almost every community, because people will take you in a campaign to where there are a lot of people. Naturally, that's to a convalescent home or a senior citizens club or something. Talk to them about their problems. I'd always worked on women's issues and been supported the Equal Rights Amendment. There were so many things I wanted to do when I got to the White House, and I was just eager to get started on my projects when I got there.
The First Lady is an unpaid position, although First Ladies always do a lot of work, and you certainly did. Do you think that there should be some formal recognition of the work of the First Lady through a salary?
Well, I was asked that question a lot of times while Jimmy was president, and the First Lady does not get paid, but there are so many advantages. I had a staff in the East Wing of the White House to help me with everything I wanted to do. I had a resident staff in the mansion. We called it the East Wing was the First Lady's, the West Wing was the President. The White House mansion, that we called it, is in the middle. And there was a resident staff to cook and do the laundry and clean the house. And so you have all of those built-in advantages to being in the White House and to being First Lady. And the president's salary I used to say the president's salary I thought was sufficient, but there's so much more than just the president's salary. I don't know whether I think the First Lady needs to be paid or not. I don't want it to be a commercial position. I liked the opportunities. That was really wonderful to have the opportunities. You have the resources of the country at your fingertips. Anybody you call will help you with any project, and that's pretty good compensation.
Right. The public expects the First Lady to be active in various causes and to do a lot of work. On the other hand, you sometimes hear, well, I didn't elect the First Lady. Why is she so active in this issue? Who asked her? How did you find that you had to walk the line between fulfilling the public's expectations and then encountering them saying, well, we didn't elect the First Lady?
Mm-hmm. Well, I had that, of course. I'd have people say, who elected you in the first place? But I was there with all kinds of opportunities, and I was really working hard to do some good things for the country, I thought. And you have to decide and be very confident about what you're doing and accept the fact that you're going to have criticisms, because the criticisms are going to come. By the time I got to the White House, Jimmy had been in the Senate, he'd been in a governor, we'd been in a campaign, and you're going to get the criticisms regardless of what you do. So you may as well be very confident about what you're doing and disregard the criticisms. And as long as I was confident that what I was doing would help people in the country, then I sometimes thought I was too blasé about the criticisms. I maybe should have listened to some of them.
Did you have a model when you entered the White House of which first lady you wanted to be most similar to?
I really didn't, because I had not studied a lot about first ladies. I knew what I wanted to do from being in the governor's mansion and having campaigned, and I just wanted to do my projects when I got there. There are first ladies that I admire. I think Lady Bird was a really wonderful first lady. She did so much for in the beautification program. She showed how, well, I'm sure other first ladies have too. Eleanor Roosevelt, of course, did wonderful things. But in my lifetime, and first lady that I saw using her influence to improve, to beautify the country, was commendable. I really admired her for that. And I thought, you know, if she can do that, and she has a lot of attention, and she has gets a lot of attention, has a lot of influence, and helps people over the whole country, then maybe what I can do. She was a good model for me. But I don't think I ever thought about it in those terms at that time.
How would you compare yourself to the current First Lady, Nancy Reagan?
I don't know. I've never tried to do that. But I think Nancy Reagan got a lot of criticism when she came into office, and I think she's turned that image around, and that's very hard to do.
Well, when you're First Lady, everything that you buy, whether it's a hat or a piece of china or a new rug, is accepted as a symbol. It becomes a symbol of, like, the nation, or, you know, the taste of the two most powerful people in the country. Did that inhibit you?
I think it could inhibit you if you'd let it. But I had been in public life long enough to know to try to disregard those things. At the governor's mansion, when Jimmy was first elected governor, I thought I had to have every hair in place and be perfect every time anybody saw me. And I thought Amy had to be perfect, and she was three. And for the first few months, I kept her dressed neatly, I was afraid people were looking at my fingernails, and I was conscious of that. And I finally decided that you can't live that way. You can't live and be a normal life and have any sense of yourself when you constantly thinking about what everybody else thinks about you. And you develop a confidence about what you can do. You accept your position, and you just go about your own life trying to do the best you can in whatever situation you're in, whether it's the governor's mansion or the White House or wherever. And so you really can't worry about everything that somebody says about you, or you couldn't survive.
Of course, you don't really have a normal life when you're in the White House. But what did you and the president do to try to inject some feel of normalcy into your marriage and into your home life?
Well, the second and third floors of the White House were home to us. We didn't have any staff except the maids and so forth, but no staffs that worked on our projects or secretaries and so forth on the second and third floors. Sometimes first ladies have had their staffs in the living quarters. And the president has an office there, but Jimmy's was a study that where we sat at in the evenings in front of the fire in the wintertime, or where we watched television. And so nobody came on the second and third floor except those people who would normally come to your home, friends. And my children went home there. They had their friends running in and out. And you could take your shoes off as soon as you got off the elevator. It was just home. And Jimmy would call me in the afternoons about 4:30. It got to be a habit. We would run, jog, or play tennis, or bowl when the weather was bad. There was a bowling alley downstairs in the White House. And I put on my calendar every day the hour that Amy came home from school to try to be there. So when I traveled, I couldn't. But if I was in my office working, I could be at home when she got home. And I might have to go back, but at least I could be a mother and be at home to see her when she came home. And so we tried to have as normal a life as we could. And one thing that was so good about it was that we had been so scouted. We had all been campaigning for 2 years, seeing each other. Jim and I tried to get home on weekends, but the children didn't, the boys. They would move to a state and just live there, in New Hampshire or Iowa or somewhere. And at the White House, we all came home. And also, when you go out of the White House, you have everybody in the family has the same situation. You have press, people recognize you, and you sign autographs and you have your picture made. There's a lot of attention. And so rather than go out, everybody treasured the times that we could just all be together at home. And it really drew the family close together. And also, the criticisms, you're the subject, every member of the family is a subject of criticism. And that kind of pulls you together too. You're taking up for each other and you're shrugging off and laughing off those things that you don't like. And it just makes you a really close-knit family. It was a good experience for us.
The First Lady and the President has enough work to work through the night every day for the entire 4 years that the President is in office. How did you structure, and how did the President structure, working days so that there was room to unwind?
Well,
and how important is that when you're in the White House? I mean, do you take the attitude of that you're going to sacrifice all your time? Because after all, you know, the whole country is depending on you. Or are you going to ensure that you have time to relax in the hopes you'll be more productive ultimately?
No, it's absolutely necessary to have some time to unwind and get away from the pressures. You never leave them totally, but you can go downstairs in the White House to a movie and just escape for a little while. I think it's really important. And Jim is better at doing that than I am. He would drag me away from my desk. when we first moved to the White House, until about the 1st August, Jimmy would go back to work at night after dinner. And after that, he started going to work earlier in the morning. He was always going at about 6:30 or something, but he started getting up at 5:30 and being that 6. And then he would call me at 4:30. And after that, he usually didn't work anymore. We would jog or do some kind of exercise, get out and clear your mind and just get some fresh air and just get everything away out of your mind for a while. Come in, have dinner, maybe see a movie. And if Jimmy had a state visit, a head of state coming or something that he had to study for, he might bring some books home with him. But most of the time, not. And then the next morning, he was ready to go back to work. But that's really important, I think. And then on weekends, we would go to Camp David. And Camp David was wonderful. And one reason that it's so wonderful is because it is a place to get away from the pressures. If you stay in the White House, the staff will call you about every problem that comes up on a weekend. If you go to Camp David, they know that you are away from it, and they're reluctant to call you. So Jimmy used to say he escaped from staff on weekends, too. And but that's so necessary. You cannot work all of the time and have the pressures all of the time. And without just letting it tear you down, I don't think. I think it would be terrible to not be able to. Jim has a great facility for doing that.
Rosalynn Carter is my guest, and she's written a memoir. It's titled First Lady from Plains. You had wanted to run a very informal White House, your husband wanted to dispense with the hail to the chiefs and a lot of the ceremony and formality of the office. And I had appeared on television in a cardigan sweater. How do you think the public ultimately reacted to that?
I don't know. We had some criticism that the public liked for their president to be maybe more of an imperial presidency, but I don't know that that's true. And the White House, while we were there, was very formal when it should have been very formal. It was informal when it should have been informal. We had the range of entertainments. We had the best entertainment in our country, the best our country had to offer in all areas. And it was fun. It was interesting. Jimmy was never comfortable with all of the trappings and hail to the chief and those kinds of things. That's his personality. I wanted hail to the chief all of the time. And we had it on state visits when there was another head of state there, military events when he was the chief, and at other times he would play it. But he just thought it was not necessary every time he walked into a room to have Hail to the Chief played. He just was never comfortable with that. Some past presidents, even if you go downstairs on the state floor and walk into a reception or anything, it was the custom to play Hail to the Chief. He just thought that was overdoing it, and we did cut that down. But it was a really wonderful, elegant White House, I thought, while we were there.
How much would he confer with you about policy decisions?
We, in the afternoons, talked about what each was doing. And he would tell me that he met with his cabinet or his HEW about a program for food stamps or something like that. You know, whatever he had been doing that day, we'd talk about it. He'd never ask my advice. We don't function that way. He told me what he did. I told him what I was doing. I'd tell him what I had learned if I had been on a trip out in the country, what people told me, things that I could take back to him. I could get a better feel for what people were thinking if I went out into the country than he could, because I didn't have the entourage he had. I would have a large enough entourage. But I could sit down in a senior citizen center and talk with people about the problems, or go into a house in New Hampshire and talk to a young couple about the high cost of fuel oil and how they were going to, could they pay their rent and pay this too? You know, I could learn the problems and come back and talk to him about it. And then maybe when he was making decisions, something that I said might influence a decision. I don't know, but I think our relationship was like any husband and wife who respect each other and have an interest in what they're doing. And there was a mutual respect. He respected my opinion about things that I was doing or things that I saw in the country. But he made the decisions.
You were sometimes represented as being the power behind him who is very influential. What did you think of that press coverage?
Well, some of it was ridiculous. People who said that I was made the decisions and so forth just didn't know Jimmy Carter. He is a very strong person. And but I did go to cabinet meetings. The reason I went to cabinet meetings was because Jimmy got so tired of me jumping on him every day when he came home to see, why did you do this, or why did you do something that I had seen on television or read in the newspaper or heard on the radio? And finally he said, why don't you come to the cabinet meetings, and then you'll know why we make these decisions or why we do these things. So I went in. It was very comfortable. I sat in the row around the back of the room with the secretaries who were there and learned. Just generally what the administration was doing, which was really important to me because I went out in the country. People asked me about what they were doing. I never knew details, but I could tell them generally what the administration was trying to do. And also I could see negative news stories and not worry about them if I knew the true facts about something. It was good for my own peace of mind. And if you live there for 4 years with all of the criticisms, you have to be very confident that you're doing what's right. And I had needed to know that, I needed for my own self, for my own benefit, to know that Jimmy was doing what he was doing and why he was doing it, and that it was good for the country and best for the country.
Were you criticized at all by cabinet members who felt uncomfortable that the president's wife was sitting in on the meetings?
Never.
What about from the public or the press? Again, the we didn't elect you syndrome, what are you doing there?
Well, as I said, I'd learned very early that I was going to be criticized. Even if I had stayed in the White House and poured tea for 4 years, I would have been criticized. So why not do? I don't know anybody. I really don't think I know anybody who wouldn't go to the cabinet meetings and sit in and listen if they had an opportunity.
The president asked you in 1977 to travel to several Latin American countries and meet with heads of state. What did you do to let the heads of state know that this wasn't just a kind of token friendly visit from the president's wife to stop in and say hello, that this was a much more political and important meeting?
Well, when a new president comes into office, all of the world wants to know him. We had hundreds of invitations for all of the heads of states in the whole world wanted to come meet the new president. And you can't have that many state visits. And you can't go to all of the world. Jimmy went to London to one economic summit. He sent the vice president somewhere. But he wanted the Latin American countries to know his policy toward them. He had made two or three speeches on foreign policy. And so he knew that I'd always been interested in Latin America. We had traveled in Mexico. I had studied Spanish for as long as I could remember. I just loved the Latin American and Caribbean people. And so he asked me how I would like to go on that trip. And of course, I was thrilled. And I had a lot of briefings. I really studied and worked hard for it. And I had criticisms, and they're not going to take you seriously, and so forth. So before I left, out of all of my briefings and from Jimmy's speeches, I made the points that Jimmy wanted them to know. He helped me. I did them, and he helped me to be sure. We wanted the countries to know that he was not going to lump them all into one Latin American policy, that he was going to consider them individually, that he was not going to introduce new weapons into an area, that kind of thing. I made a list of all of the points. And when I went in to meet a head of state, I had my notebook, and I had that general review of his foreign policy as it pertained to Latin America. And then I had the specific questions that I wanted to ask that head of state about the particular country I was in. So we would go in and we'd start our conversation, and at first some of them would be reluctant to discuss an issue with me. And I always had our ambassador in that country with me, and a young man from National Security Council and one from the State Department. And sometimes the head of state would direct their questions or things to them. Well, I would get out my summary, and I would say, now I want to talk to you about these things that Jimmy thinks are important. And I would go over it, and by the time I got through going over it, they would know that I knew basically how what Jimmy wanted them to know. But the thing that I found was, and then we would go into some substantive conversation, the thing I found was that everybody was wrong about the way I would be accepted, because there's not a world leader who doesn't want to talk to the President of the United States. Not one. And these people knew that I was the person closest to Jimmy Carter. And if they told me something, I could take it back to Jimmy. And it wouldn't have to go through the State Department or anything. It would go straight to him. They were eager to tell me their problems and what they wanted the President of the United States to know. So it was a good reception and a really good visit.
How important is the personal chemistry that heads of state have with each other?
Probably important. I found at the White House that I was worried about protocol, whether I would make a mistake when I first went, and whether I would be at ease with heads of state and their wives and so forth. We had a briefing book from the State Department with a biographical sketch of every foreign visitor that came, the people who came with him, the wife. It had all of the important issues, the things that you needed to talk to them about, and the things that subjects you need to avoid. I studied those very carefully before every state visit. But I found that coming to the White House for almost anybody is awesome. It's awesome to me. And so I found myself putting the wife of a head of state at ease. Instead of being nervous about what I was going to say, I was trying to make them comfortable. I learned that protocol is just being warm and friendly. Mm-hmm. You really don't have to worry about anything else. It's really Southern hospitality.
You had mentioned before that for many years, been interested in Latin America, speak Spanish. I'd like to hear your impressions of America's current policy in El Salvador and Nicaragua.
I am totally opposed to everything that's being done. Jimmy Carter had worked so hard to broaden the center of those administrations of the administration in El Salvador, for instance, so that the people would respect the government and not rebel against it. And he forced the government to be interested in land reform and to consider the human rights of the people before they received any aid from our country. And it was working. It was tenuous. It was a touchy situation. But the only way there will ever be peace in that area is for the people to respect the government. And they do not respect the government that tortures and represses them. In Nicaragua, the Nicaraguans had been under a military dictatorship, a regressive, terrible regime for years. And the Sandinistas took this group took over. And when they took over, they didn't know what they wanted to do. They had just overthrown a government. And we were trying to woo them and show them that democracy was best for them. This administration, the Reagan administration, has run them straight into the hands of the communists. Where else could they go? We finance those who rebel against the government. Where else can the government go except straight to Russia, straight to Cuba? Where else can the people of El Salvador? They will never respect our government if our government supports a repressive regime. I just think everything we're doing in Latin America, in Central America, is wrong.
What effects do you think it's going to have on us?
I think it's going to take us a long time to get over, and I think it's really a tinderbox. We have committed ourselves now to, with military arms, and can you imagine my country mining the harbors in Nicaragua? Can you imagine my country financing Contras who harm people who have who are totally innocent? We have a friend who just got back from Nicaragua and brought back pictures. He hitchhiked all through and brought back pictures of houses and stuff that have been shelled. He talked to the Contras, too, and they say that they don't harm innocent people, but they do. There's no way they can. And they shell fire mortars into an area. In fact, this one woman, and this is a horrible thing to say, but it happened, had a picture of a woman whose four-year-old little girl was beheaded by a mortar shell. I mean, we pay for those. We finance that. I can't stand it. I just can't stand it.
You know, I'm thinking in your 1977 trip to meet different Latin American heads of state, you probably met with dictators as well as democratically elected leaders. Did you find your own demeanor with them changing according to your perceptions of their rule over the country?
No, I did not go to any country that was not leaning toward democracy. I had a running, real fun time with one of the ambassadors from, I think it was Paraguay, that wanted me to come visit his country. And I would tease, he was their ambassador in Washington. I used to tease him, you form a democracy and I'll come. And we just had this thing. And so the Latin American people knew that to get any recognition from the United States, they had to work toward democracy. And that's the way to do it, not by a show of military strength. We don't have to show our military strength. Everybody in the world knows we're the strongest country in the world. And so there were some dictators that I met with, Morales Bermudez in Peru, for instance, but he was in the process of changing his government into a democracy. And before Jimmy left office, they elected a president, and I went down to his inauguration. The same thing happened in Ecuador. And then when the Reagan administration came in, the first thing they did was embrace all of the military dictators. There are two theories on how to deal with countries like that. This administration thinks that if you back military leaders or dictators are more stable. If you let the people decide who they want, who are they going to decide on? Or what kind of government are they going to choose? And so do you embrace a military dictator in the name of stability, or do you try to help those countries have a democratic government and see who they elect and hope that they will be our friends? So there's, you know, the different theories about it. Jimmy believed that the people should have a government that they approved of, a democratic government that they approved of. The Reagan administration thinks that you should embrace whoever's in power in charge in the name of stability.
Rosalind Carter is my guest, and she's written a memoir. It's titled First Lady from Plains. You were at Camp David during the summit with Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin that led to the Camp David Accords. What were the dynamics between President Carter, Sadat, and Begin, the kind of personal dynamics between them that influenced the way the negotiations went?
Well, Jimmy and Prime Minister Begin understood each other. One knew exactly how far he could go with the other to get him to respond in a favorable way. For instance, when Prime Minister Begin sent troops into Lebanon while Jimmy was president, and Jimmy sent him word if he didn't pull them out, we'd cut off all aid. Well, it'd be very hard for a president to cut off all aid, but Prime Minister Begin knew he could make it very difficult for him, and he pulled his troops out. When they went in this time, this administration gave him the green light, we understand. But they understood each other and had a working relationship. Jimmy did not know whether Prime Minister Begin would actually sign a peace agreement. But Sadat and Jimmy got along just really well because Sadat wanted a peace agreement, and Jimmy wanted to work with him. And he was really the first head of an Arab country that had been willing to recognize Israel and want to work for peace. And so there was a rapport between them. And at Camp David, Prime Minister Begin is a really charming man, and interesting to talk with. Speaks 7 or 8 different languages. I always enjoyed being with him. But he had some really strongly held beliefs about what he wanted for his country, and Jimmy argued with him a lot about it. But Prime Minister Begin and President Sadat did not get along at all. In fact, they did not see each other for the last 10 days of the summit. And the only way there was a chance of getting an agreement was to keep them apart. And so it was an interesting situation. Jimmy would meet with one, then he would meet with the other. And then he would meet with the people who, Prime Minister Begin's people and then Sadat's people, and to work on the terms of the treaty. And people that they trusted, each one sent someone to work with Jimmy on the final terms of the treaty. And it was not until the Sunday that they decided to sign the peace accord that they saw each other again. But it was really interesting because we went to the a Sabbath dinner with the Israelis on that Friday night. And I sat next to Prime Minister Begin, and he said, "You know, that Sadat's a nice man. Do you know," he said to me, "Mr. Begin, Mr. Begin, Mr. Begin." He said, at first he didn't call me by my name. But then they never did see each other again until Sunday. But it was interesting to be there. And I wrote all of the time I was there. I wrote, when I got it all typed up, it was about 200 pages of notes about that. And I wrote a chapter in my book about it. I tried to put things that had not written before about the living, how way everyone lived, and the food, the movies that we saw, those kinds of things, plus some of the substance, because you can't write about moods and feelings, emotional feelings, without writing some of the substance, some of the issues, so that you would get an idea of what caused those feelings. But it was interesting.
What was your role as the First Lady during the summit meeting?
Well, Jimmy wanted all of the wives there. He wanted Jehan and Alisa Begin, because we had learned that with Prime Minister Begin, he was much more open if Alisa was there. Sitting around a dinner table talking, he would really expound. Then if he went off with Jimmy to talk about the same situation, the same peace process, he was very careful. He would kind of close up. And so Jimmy wanted the wives there. He thought that there were going to be a lot of tensions, and that if the wives were there, it would be good to have them to divert some of that tension. And Mrs. Begin came. But Jehan's granddaughter, Mrs. Sadat's grandchild, was in the hospital in Paris, and she had to be there. I was sorry she couldn't come. And I really believe that one of the reasons that Prime Minister Begin stayed the whole time was because his wife was there.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Rosalind Carter, and I'd like to mention that she's written a memoir about her life and about her 4 years in the White House. It's called First Lady from Plains. You took a flight with your husband in the plane. I forget what the name of the plane is, but it's the one that's supposed to take off and command from the air in case of nuclear attack.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe what that experience was like?
Well, Jimmy wanted to test that system to see if it worked, because no president, I don't think, had ridden on that plane to really try it out to see if it worked. And so we were going home to plane, just a regular scheduled trip that we had planned for a good while, and he decided to take that plane. And it was really, it was frightening to think what it was, the purpose of it. And all the time that you were in there, no windows in it, sealed in with all of that communications equipment, so that you could, the president could be in touch with any spot in the world, the Soviet Union also, and with the country. It was divided into little compartments. And to just think of the purpose of it was something. I know that when we landed in planes, I was glad to get out and be on familiar ground. We didn't land in planes when we landed.
Back in Washington?
No. We went home and we landed at an Air Force base that's close to home.
What's the inside like besides not having windows? I don't know how much you're at liberty to describe that, but if you are, I'd be interested in hearing about it.
Well, I think that's really all I remember about it, is how closed in it was and that it was divided into little compartments with the communications equipment and I don't know what else. Jimmy had a briefing on the whole plane while we were on that I did not participate in, that I stayed in the little compartment that was for the president.
When the hostages were taken in Iran, that was a real, turning point for the presidency, I think. There were, I'm sure, lots of recommendations about what the president should be doing to get the hostages back. What are some of the things that President Carter rejected on the grounds that it would be too risky, too potentially dangerous?
Well, when they were first taken, we just thought that the government would remove them because they had been taken before. The embassy had been taken over by the radical students before. And so we kept thinking that they would, and then it, you know, if it went on for a few hours and a few days and it didn't, we realized that Khomeini was going to release them, and then he realized how popular it was, and he needed some popular support at that time. But there were all kinds of things, like I used to get upset. I said, why don't you do something? And he'd say, what do you want me to do? I'd say, mind the harbors. And he said, all right, they have our people. Suppose I mind the harbors, and our minds are there, and they're there for a week, and then they're there for 2 weeks. Or suppose that the Iranians say, well, we're going to take one hostage and execute them, one every day until you remove the mines. You know, they had our people. And there were all kinds of things that everybody thought were, and there was all kinds of pressure to do something. The problem was that Tehran was so far inland. If it had not been so far and so inaccessible, if it had been on the coast, you could have done something. But so far inland that you couldn't get to them, they were out of reach. And also, there was the Soviet Union sitting right there waiting for us to do something like that, to come in. We would have been at war if Jimmy had bombed Tehran and probably killed the hostages in the process. So, looking back on it, it was a terrible situation for us. But I'm glad he was the one in charge, because it could have been a devastating thing for our country.
I think public perception was initially, I'm so glad the president isn't losing his cool.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly there was a shift in public perception to, why doesn't he do something?
That's right.
When did you start to feel that shift?
Well, I was out campaigning, and I could tell when it was changing. And that's when I would come home to Jimmy and say, why don't you do something?
Yeah.
But I watched him very carefully weigh every decision he made. He took all of the diplomatic steps. He had the support of the whole world, which is most unusual, to have the support of all the other countries for what he was doing. He did not lose his cool. And then it takes a very strong, very patient person to wait that out. There was no one to negotiate with. That was the problem. There was nobody in the country strong enough who had enough control to negotiate with. And so with nobody there, it made some people said it made Jimmy look weak, made our country look weak. But what people don't realize is that a weaker nation, a weaker country than ours would have had to do something drastic or dramatic to show their power and to show that we didn't have to do that. Everybody always already knows we're powerful. But it takes a very strong person to resist all of that pressure and wait it out and bring the hostages safely home.
There was a break in the waiting it out tactics when the rescue attempt was undertaken.
From the very beginning, they started making plans for a military operation. And then when they decided that there was no way to get them out unless we went in for them, no way, because with nobody to... We kept thinking all the time that somebody would come into power that we could negotiate with. There were always talk of somebody taking over and so forth, being strong. But when that didn't happen, and you knew the only way you were going to get them out was to go get them, the military operation that they had been working on from the very beginning, back in November, as soon as they were captured, had been really refined and had worked down to this particular one. And everybody, I mean, not everybody, but Jimmy was confident, and the people that were doing it were confident that they could go in and take them out, get them out. And everything was worked out to the last detail. In my book, I described some of those details. And I left to go on a campaign trip. I wanted to stay there close to the White House so I'd know what was going on, because I thought it was going to be so exciting to have them all home. And I left on that trip thinking that I was going to get a call while I was out there saying the hostages had been rescued. And, that was the worst day of my life. When I called Jimmy, I couldn't stand not to know anymore. And I got to Detroit for a final appearance in the afternoon before going to Texas to spend the night. And I called him and I said, you know, what's happening? Are they free? And he said, no. And I said, what's the matter? He said, I can't talk about it. Well, I could tell by the tone of his voice that it was bad. It was terrible. He tried. And you have to try. It didn't work, but Jim has always told me that you don't accomplish anything if you don't try. If he had not run for president because he thought it would be hard, he would never have been elected president. He had to try to get them out. But once you try the mission failed, there's no reason to try again. I mean, there's no way they were scattered all at that, and then you just had to wait it out.
Some people said that the reason for the timing of that rescue attempt was to help his ratings in the polls for the election. Yeah, what'd you say to that?
I said, it's ridiculous. People don't, and people who say that, most of that starts with opponents. That's a good political issue. And your opponents pounce on it, and then it gets bandied around, and people start maybe believing, and it was absolutely false.
President Carter negotiated and tried to work on the hostage release till the very last minute. And the hostages were set free immediately upon the inauguration of President Reagan. Why do you think Khomeini planned it that way?
Because he didn't want to release them on Jimmy's watch. I really believe that, because they were sitting on the runway in the airplane ready to go. But, you know, I just hoped and prayed for the hostages to come home. Before the election, after the election, I wanted them to come home while Jimmy was still president. I thought that if they didn't come home, the new administration would have to start another whole round of negotiation. Everything would be lost. They might not ever get home. And I just hoped and prayed it would be while Jimmy was president. That might have been selfish, but I couldn't help it. I wanted that. And then we were so excited in the end when it seemed to be working. I know we went on to Camp David knowing that something might happen, but not wanting that for that last weekend before the Reagan's inauguration, and knowing that it might happen, but not wanting to sit there and wait and then be disappointed again because we had had our hopes up so much and been dashed so much. And I thought it was going to be horrible to leave Camp David for the last time because I had loved it. And that message came through, and we threw our things in the bag and flew back to the White House and goodbye, Camp David. You know, the hostages were coming home. We were thrilled. And then the clock started ticking and there were this hang-ups and so forth. And I kept thinking, they're not going to come home while Jimmy's president. They're not going to come home. And then that last morning when they were in the airplanes and on the runway, and I had to get Jimmy to come home because it was time for the Reagans to come, and we were walking back, and all of a sudden it didn't matter. Just so they came home. It didn't matter. We had done all we could do. He had done all he could do. And it didn't matter if they didn't come home while he was president because they were coming home. And that's just how it felt. And I went to that inauguration thrilled because the hostages were coming home. Instead of it being a sad thing because it was our last day. You know, we knew it and nobody else knew it. And you couldn't tell anybody. In the car with Nancy Reagan on the way to the inauguration, I couldn't tell her that the hostages were coming home. And I was just bursting inside. And it's a good way to go out of office.
Do you think your husband got enough credit in their release?
Well, no, to be perfectly honest. But so what, you know? I really don't have to worry about things like that because it's all there. The whole record is there. And history will show what he did.
Do you think that that hostage manipulation of freeing them exactly at the moment of Reagan's inauguration made for a more difficult or even bitter transition between you and the Reagans?
I don't think so. No, I don't think that I don't think that that made it bitter at all. In fact, it was really not that bitter. When Jimmy went into office, the Ford White House just opened up and everybody worked with us and we were really interested. Jimmy met with all the congressional leaders, had them down to Georgia with the White House and so forth so that it would be a smooth transition. And the Reagan people, we did the same thing for the Reagan people. Some of it they took advantage of. They weren't not as interested in as we had been in wanting, you know, to know and so forth about what was going on. But, you know, that's just the way it was.
How did it feel to return to Plains after 4 years in the White House? I think you were probably surprised that your tenure there was ending after the first 4 years.
Well, I was surprised in November, but you lose in November, the 1st of November, and then you don't go home till January the 20th. And so in that period of time, you were reconciled, and by the January 20th, you're just ready to go home. And I was really bitter when we lost because I didn't think we were going to lose. And I was not bitter with the American people because I always thought if they knew what Jimmy was doing and that they would vote for him. I still believe that. And I think that hostage thing that came up right at the end and the anniversary of the hostage capture brought back all of the frustrations, and I think that that's what defeated him. But by January, I was ready. You know, I knew I was going, and I was ready to go home. But I did think I would be bored when I got home and that probably all of my interesting experiences were over. And that's when I thought, well, this is a good time for me to write my book because I'll have nothing to do. Oh, I was so wrong. Being out of office is really exciting and fulfilling because you have all of the resources still there at your fingertips. I can call anybody in the world that I want to help me with anything that I'm working on. The resources are still there. And so it's a interesting, exciting life after the White House also.
You know, a lot of people find that when they're in a certain position of power professionally, that everybody's interested in them and wants to do them favors. And as soon as they leave that position, that all those people couldn't care less. I guess that doesn't happen with the First Lady.
It really doesn't. And that's one thing we talked about at that First Lady conference, how the opportunities are still there. And you can do anything. I'm getting restless to start working back on my projects that I was interested in. Say, I've been writing the book. And I had to, at first I made a few speeches and so forth. But I had to quit because just as I would be writing something really good, I would have to quit, write a speech, go make it, come home, and then it was all lost. So I started turning down everything. And I thought I could breeze through it in a year. It took me 2 years and 10 months to write it. But I'm working with the Emory University officials in Atlanta about ways I can continue my mental health work from an institutional base. Jimmy's Carter Center, which will be part of the Carter Presidential Library on the same site, will be a school of Emory University, like the law school, the med school, and he can work on the things that he was interested in. He's already working on Mideast peace and health projects and Soviet-U.S. relations, including disarmament. And Gerald Ford, he has asked to co-chair two of those studies with him, as a matter of fact. And it's just been exciting for both of us.
Do you think Americans don't know how to use to full advantage their former presidents and first ladies? Because a lot of times they drop out of sight.
Well, it's up to to me. I know I don't have any pressure to do anything. It's up to me to decide what I want to do. And it might be good if there was some... Well, particularly presidents. Jimmy's been called twice by President Reagan. Once when he wanted support for the sale of AWACS to Saudi Arabia or something very early. And he called him before he went to China. And I heard an answer that he called Nixon, Ford, and Carter. But there is so much experience and so much knowledge there. We had an office that stayed in touch with the former presidents all the time, kept them briefed on all events and used the help in passing the Panama Canal treaties and all the things that were really important. But Jimmy is not, but he hadn't missed it because he's been so busy and has these things that he's been working on. But whether he misses it or not, it's a waste to the American people.
You've described yourself as a political partner with your husband, Jimmy Carter. Did you have to work hard to achieve that partnership?
It just kind of developed from being in the Navy and learning to take care of things while he was gone and then coming home and working and building the peanut business together, and then going to Governor's mansion and doing my thing. It just developed a mutual respect for what the other could do.
Would you ever run for office yourself?
Well, I don't have any plans to, no. I wouldn't say I'll never run, because I don't know what the future holds, but I have so many interesting things to do right now that I have not thought about running for office.
Well, Rosalind Carter, I want to thank you very much for spending the past hour with us. It's been most interesting. Thank you very much for talking with us.
Good. I enjoyed it.